Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, the 29th of September, 1999. We're in the Village Center this morning as we continue with the Lens Conference. Presenter Dr. Barbara Rossing presents Let All Who Thirst Come. Your session number is Lens 99-7. Let's listen in.
Today I want to start by talking about this beautiful triptych here. Sorry that we had you turn your benches around, but created by Kristen Gilia, the village artist here at Holden Village, this represents what has been the summer theme here at Holden, Tree of Life. And it's an image from the New Jerusalem vision of Revelation 21 and 22. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. It started long ago in Genesis, this river of God's water of life. It started east of Eden, then it flowed out of the temple in Ezekiel, the 47th chapter. Remember that river that brings fresh water and life to all that it touches, life to make the stagnant water live. It brought fish, it watered the tree on either side. It's the river of the water of life where we were all baptized, we and every Christian from every time. Here's Kristen Gilia just coming in the door. She's the designer of the triptych. I just mentioned you. Anyway, it's lovely. Okay. The river of the water of life is the river where each of us was baptized, Christians from every time and every place. The Ethiopian eunuch in the book of Acts, Lydia and her whole family in Philippi. It's the river of hope that flowed through the lives of some 30,000 young people and their sponsors in New Orleans a year ago, I think, or 2 years ago. I'm sure many of you were there at the youth gathering. It's the river of hope that flows through our lives, carrying us into the future to face every change that will come our way in the next millennium. It's the river of life that flows from the heart of Jesus in the Gospel of John. It's the river of life that becomes for us, for all who thirst, for all who seek, a spring of water gushing up into eternal life. This is the water of life that the book of Revelation closes with. And today, I know all of you have preached on these texts so often, so I do not presume to be offering something new. But what I want to do with you today is paddle around, if you will, in these images from Revelation 21 and 22 and look at some aspects of that river of life, the tree of life. Look at the New Jerusalem vision and what it might say for us today in our ministries. Because I think in some ways, ministry is about helping people find and follow that river of life in their lives. Sometimes it goes underground, sometimes they can't find it, sometimes they feel all dried up. I preached on this text at LSTC a couple years ago, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, you know, there used to be a stream that flowed right where the seminary is located today. And I said, you're kidding. And they said, no, a stream flowed through Hyde Park. It's now been paved over, but you can find it still. And I said, well, how is that? And he said, follow the cottonwoods. And indeed, through the neighborhood, I mean, it's hard, but you can see that there's areas that have more water, and it's following the trace of those cottonwoods. So even when the river of water of life goes underground in our lives, we've got the trees. And we can help people follow those cottonwoods. So that's what I want to do a little bit today, is look at some of the imagery of this vision and how I think in some ways it's the most hope-filled vision in all of Scripture. Someone asked last night, what do you see as the most pressing world problems and church problems? I think I would answer several things. The problem of violence, the problem of ecological destruction, the problem of the economic situation of globalization in our world today that both destroys the environment and its resources and leaves increasing numbers of people behind. I've got an article coming out in the December issue of Lutheran Women Today about these Left Behind novels that I talked about the first night. And I think in some ways the most pressing problem for the church isn't this idea of the rapture and the putting the fear of people in that they'll be left behind when Jesus snatches people off the earth. It's rather the problem that we are leaving people behind in the world. But in the New Jerusalem vision, God comes to earth to live with us. That diagram, I mean, I really do believe it to be important that in chapter 21, the throne of God descends to earth and God comes to make a tent, a skene, a home with people on earth, and that this is where God's home is. So it's not a matter of God leaving people behind as we're somehow snatched off the earth. It's rather God coming to dwell with us, and we need to face the question of who are we leaving behind in this globalized political and economic situation. But I do, the thesis that I want to argue with you today is that the New Jerusalem vision at the end of Revelation can be a resource for the church to face these issues. And what I want to do today is look at the New Jerusalem vision from several different angles. First of all, as a counterpart to the Babylon vision or the critique of Rome that we find in chapters 13 and also 17 and 18. And that'll be the longest section, so don't worry when that takes up most of the time. Second of all, look at the New Jerusalem vision as a fulfillment of the promises of Revelation 2 and 3, the seven letters to the seven churches at the beginning of the book that then find their fulfillment in chapter 21. And that's why I put up this diagram here. This is one model for the structure of Revelation proposed by Elizabeth Schisler Fiorenza, now picked up by many others. It's not so important where the exact breaks are, what passage falls in what section, but the idea of the concentric structure of Revelation, where the promises of the B section are fulfilled there in B prime in the New Jerusalem vision. That's what I want to talk about. But don't worry about the numbers of the verses and stuff. Third of all, I want to talk about the New Jerusalem vision as a fulfillment of Old Testament hopes and dreams, because the use of prophecy here, I think, is quite wonderful. And finally, propose to you, ask you how this can be a resource for us today, how this vision indeed fulfills our hopes and gives us hope for the world today. And I think we can talk together about that question. Okay, first of all, how the New Jerusalem vision is a counterpart or opposite to the Babylon vision. After the fall of Satan in chapter 12, where Satan is stalking the earth, so things are getting worse, in chapter 13, Rome is introduced in the persona of these two beasts, the beast from the land and the beast from the sea. And in chapter 13, which Pablo Richard calls a critical analysis of the structures of Rome's oppression, and it really is a critical look at Rome, the issues of proskuneisis, it come up again very centrally. Whom do you give allegiance to, and what does it mean for Christians to refuse to give allegiance to Rome? Those are the questions that are addressed in chapter 13. And parenthetically here, I want to do a little aside. Somebody mentioned the William Stringfellow commentary the first night. He was one of the first to point out this as an example of the diversity of the New Testament, and he wanted us to sort of embrace Revelation 13. There are probably no two more opposite chapters of the New Testament than Romans 13, which is the, you know, endorsement of obeying government, and Revelation 13. And both of them are in our biblical canon. And that's an example, I think, of how I would never argue that Revelation should be at the center of our canon, nor that, I mean, if this guy is the sort of Pat Buchanan of the New Testament, I don't vote for Pat Buchanan. But I think the critique of Rome that we find in Revelation is very important at times for the church. And indeed, South African Christians tell about how important it was to oppose the apartheid theology, which would lift up Romans 13 and the admonition there to obey government. They would lift up Revelation 13 as a counterpoint to that. But I view the New Testament as a wonderfully diverse community of voices. I put on the shelf in the bookstore a book by my colleague David Rhodes, a new book called The Challenge of Diversity. And what he does is use the model of the diverse witnesses of the New Testament, some of which are even contradictory voices. as a model now for how the church can embrace diversity and have different voices be encompassed in the wide stream of our church. And I guess as I think about the river of life in Revelation, the image I'm using now as a former geology student is the image of a braided stream that has many different channels. Those of you, well, there is a footbridge now in between on your way to Heart Lake, but it goes out every year. And same thing with after Heart Lake, as you try to make your way up to Lyman Lake, the whole reason they can't put the bridge in is because the stream is always shifting and changing. Those are examples of braided streams. And a braided stream is a wide channel with many different pieces of the river weaving together and then separating. And these are the most beautiful streams to fly over because every time the stream braids, it shines in the sun. I mean, it's a beautiful model of a stream. So I think we don't have to be looking for unanimity of voices in the church or even in the New Testament. We will not find that. But we can enjoy the braid. And Revelation is certainly way out there on the braided stream, but it has indeed become one of my favorite books now, and especially this New Jerusalem vision. So that's just a parenthesis on how we deal with New Testament diversity. In Revelation 13, then, Rome is these two beasts. In chapter 17, what John does is come up with a new image for Rome, and that is the image of a prostitute, the whore of Babylon, the great whore riding on the beast. So he's definitely linking the prostitute to Rome, which is by now familiar from chapter 13. She's riding on that multi-headed beast. She holds in her hand the cup of the abominations of her fornications. She's portrayed here as a seducer and an intoxicator of the world. And what this vision then is getting at is the seductive and dangerous aspects of participation in the Roman economy. Obviously, in chapter 13, Rome is thoroughly repulsive, and no one would want to participate in that. But in chapter 17, John acknowledges that there are enticing aspects for Christians, even, of this empire Rome and its globalized economy. And so he paints this portrait here of how, even though it might look enticing, it's nonetheless very dangerous and must be resisted. In shaping this portrait, he's drawing on Old Testament oracles, Jeremiah, Ezekiel 16 and 23 we talked about. I'm not sure how important those are. What's interesting is he calls this prostitute Babylon. So then he can draw on the whole wealth of Old Testament anti-Babylon oracles from Jeremiah 50 and 51 and other places. Why is she named Babylon? Why not Rome? I mean, is Babylon code language? He's using the name Babylon probably because only once before had the holy city of Jerusalem ever been thoroughly destroyed and utterly demolished, and that was by the Babylonians in 587. Just 20 years before the writing of Revelation, 25 years in 70, Rome had done the same thing. So he's drawing here a direct link between what Babylon did in the Old Testament to Jerusalem and what Rome had recently done to Jerusalem in the New Testament. And that opens up then the whole wealth of anti-Babylon texts from the Hebrew prophets that he draws extensively on in shaping this vision. But what's interesting is that in chapter 18 of the Babylon critique, he doesn't just confine himself to anti-Babylon oracles, even though he names the city Babylon, but he draws also on the anti-Tyre oracles, using the Old Testament critiques of this great Phoenician city that was on the west coast of Asia Minor, further north, or of Palestine, further north. And Tyre had been a mighty, mighty shipping power. It was the merchant marine center of the ancient world several times. All the great trade passed through Tyre during much of Israel's history. And Tyre was the dominating power of the Mediterranean Sea. Ezekiel 26 and 27 are a scathing critique of Tyre, using the genre of lament which is really interesting, prophetic lament, to taunt Tyre in advance of its destruction and foretell that it would soon be destroyed. And it's like a funerary lament for a city that is carefully crafted in Ezekiel, focusing on the trade that Tyre had engaged on, taking produce from all the nations of the Near East, from Israel and Judah. Tyre took its grain, millet, wheat, and traded then for luxury goods that the elites of Israel wanted. This is all condemned in the laments over Tyre, which then are picked up in Revelation 18 and becoming laments over Rome, foretelling in advance the destruction of the Roman Empire, here named Babylon, not Rome or Tyre, but using clearly the oracles from Ezekiel 26 and 27 to draw this all-encompassing critique of an entire political economy that the mourners watch sink into the sea and burn up in smoke. And the mourners are named in Revelation 18 as the kings, the merchants, and the mariners. Not the mirror, I guess in Seattle or in Washington, one should say the seafarers. But anyway, it's the shippers, it's the... And in Revelation 18:4, the call to God's people is to come out of this political economy, to cease, to the extent that people have participated in this, the call is to come out of her, O my people, lest you share in her sins and take part in her plagues. So God's people are called to step out of this, step out of participation, whatever that means. And that's what we need to talk about, what it meant then and what it means today in our communities, in order to participate in God's alternative city. And both of them are called cities. The Greek word is polis, like metropolis. The polis of Rome and the polis of New Jerusalem are structured as opposites, and God's people are called out of the one into the other in order to enter into God's New Jerusalem, the alternative world. I mentioned the first day that I think that cargo list at the center of Revelation 18 is very important for us. The slave critique there, the critique of slave trading that is part of this. Every ancient historian that has looked at this vision, classicists, Ramsay MacMullen, for example, says this is one of the most daring critiques of the Roman Empire that was written by anyone in the ancient empire. And it was written by a Christian. It was written by John. It was a very daring, hard-hitting critique of Rome, where John looks at its whole economy and says, this cannot last. This is unjust. The New Jerusalem vision, then, is the place that is the alternative space for those who come out of Babylon. And it's held up in Revelation 21 and 22, after the judgment of Revelation 20. This is the alternative to the lake of fire, to Babylon. This is the invitational city, which is the vision that gives hope to God's people. Certainly it's a vision of heaven, and at my funeral, when I die at the ripe old age of 350 or whatever it's, where are you? Anyway, whenever it is, we're going to die after we get those theramones. What are they? What are those enzymes that are going to keep us alive 200 more years? Okay. Anyway, at our funerals, of course, I want you to preach on the New Jerusalem vision. It's a vision of heaven. It's picking up on Revelation 7. But I want to look at it today also as a vision that we can glimpse even now, and that's part of our calling as pastors and leaders in the church, is to help lift up this vision and invite people to glimpse this and live in terms of God's vision of the New Jerusalem even now. It couldn't be more different from the Babylon vision, and I want to point out some of those contrasts. It's clear that the two cities are structured as diametrical opposites. One way you can see it is by looking at the introductions to the two visions, chapter 17 and Revelation 21, 9 and following. I'll read and just show you the link. In chapter 21, it's, then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues. That's the very same angel is showing the Babylon vision at the beginning of 17. saying, come, I will show you. That's the exact same words. And in the case of the one, it's, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. In the case of the other, it's, I will show you the judgment of the great whore. And then both of them continue, and in the spirit, the angel carried me. And in the case of the New Jerusalem vision, it's to a great high mountain to see the holy city. And in the case of the Babylon vision, it's into an eremos or wasteland, sometimes translated as desert, but I think it's more the sense of an urban wasteland, a devastated city that has been destroyed. And this very tightly structured introduction to the two visions shows us as readers that they are meant to be read as opposites of one another. And throughout the whole New Jerusalem vision, you can see aspects of that contrast. I'll just point out a few. He's making the argument very strongly at the beginning of chapter 21 that it's new. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. Why does he say the sea is no more? If we look at it as the opposite of Babylon, and of course there's a lot, I'm just presenting one scholarly position here, there's a lot of options here, but if it's the opposite of Babylon, what you see at the center of the Babylon vision is the shipping economy, where trade is what dominates Rome in the depiction in Revelation 18. The mariners, the merchants, their wealth depends on sea trade. So the fact that there will be no more sea in God's New Jerusalem means that there's no more trade. No harbor, no ships, no more merchants. The economy of Babylon has also passed away with the end of the sea. And there's a different kind of economy that we will see in God's New Jerusalem. And it's an economy that he describes twice in terms of the Greek word doreon, which means as a gift, without payment, no cost. You find it in Revelation 21, verse 6. To the thirsty, I will give from the fountain of the water of life without money or without payment, doreon. And you find it again in chapter 22, the invitation of the bridal city to anyone who thirsts to come. In verse 17, let the one who hears says come, and let the one who is thirsty come, let the one who desires take the water of life, doreon. No money. And I saw the sort of economic aspect of what I had long thought to be a strictly theological term. One time when I was on a trip in Greece, we pulled up into the mobile station. And you could tell it was a mobile station because of the horses and stuff. And you read mobile then in Greek. It's fun to use your Greek on the road signs. And there was a picture of a glass on a sign, a drinking glass, like the glasses in the dining hall, and then it said doreon. And I realized what it was suddenly. It said poterion, doreon. That was a funny thing, because poterion, you know, is the word for, at the Last Supper, Jesus took the cup, gave thanks, gave it for all to drink. So you think of this as a very theological kind of cup, and there it is. Poterion is a drinking glass, and it's doreon, and you realize what the sign says is free glass with a fill-up. So anyway, that's poterion doreon. Doreon means you don't have to pay for something. The essentials of life in the New Jerusalem vision, the water of life, the health of people, the symbolized in the leaves of the tree of life, for the healing of the nations, these are all given doreon without payment. And this is in sharp contrast to the Babylon vision. This is a gift economy. And I think what you see here is what African-American spirituals have long known, which is that the New Jerusalem vision is a vision that we can sing about for hope for the future, the golden shoes, the golden streets, everything that is different from what we now experience, scarcity. It's all going to be different in God's New Jerusalem. And this vision has long been used. William Blake used the New Jerusalem vision to critique the mills of industrial England when he wrote that poem, "Was Jerusalem builded here amid these dark satanic mills? I will not cease from mental fight until we have builded Jerusalem on England's green and pleasant shore land." I think it is, can't remember that one. Anyway, it's in Chariots of Fire. But this vision is one that gives hope to people who find their situation so very different. And it's one that we can continue to lift up as a contrast to Babylon, or whatever that means for people today. The aspect of it that hasn't been explored very much that I'm working on right now is the ecological dimension. Because I do think that in the New Jerusalem vision, these aren't just theological waters and theological trees, but they have something to say to the real waters and trees of our world and our lives. A new study, a Roman Catholic bishop's pastoral letter on the Columbia River Basin. I don't know how many of you have seen it. Actually, you're having hearings now on the Columbia River, at least in the Eastern Washington, Idaho Synod, I saw that. But Bishop Skilstead from Spokane Diocese sort of got this project going, and now all the bishops from the whole Columbia River Basin, Roman Catholic bishops, so Western Montana, British Columbia, Oregon, Washington, they've all signed on to this very interesting draft pastoral letter on a watershed, looking at competing interests within the watershed, looking at claims of loggers, claims of farmers, claims of the salmon who have a voice here in this document, claims of the dams, and trying to adjudicate how do we look at this watershed as living water? How do we see the beautiful Columbia River as a sacramental commons that in some way embodies the river of life flowing through God's New Jerusalem? And so it's a very interesting kind of all-encompassing ecological, economic, political look at a watershed in light of some of the metaphors of the New Jerusalem vision, the water, the trees. A few of the other contrasts of this text you see obviously in the opening section, where there's no death anymore, where God will wipe away every tear from people's eyes, there shall be no more mourning, nor crying, nor pain. All the things that were so prominent in Babylon are now said to be no more. Uk eti is the Greek word, no longer. And I think in some ways the most important word in this opening section here is the word skene. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the skene, or dwelling of God, is with people. God will dwell with them." This is the same word that is used in the prologue to the Gospel of John, where the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. It's the Old Testament tabernacle traditions now, God coming to tabernacle with us. And that's how the New Jerusalem vision is described, that God comes now to this new earth to dwell with people. God's throne is found in the center of the holy city, and it's out from the throne that the waters of life flow. So those are a few things about the contrast to the Babylon vision. I want to just say now a word about how the New Jerusalem vision fulfills the promises that sort of set up the expectation for a New Jerusalem in chapters 2 and 3. In the seven opening letters to the seven cities, which I skipped over entirely here, they all follow a highly structured pattern. To the angel of the church of such and such, write, and then there's a diagnosis of that church's situation, which is both positive and negative, but usually more negative than positive. But John's a good pastor. He at least starts with the positive when he can. So he diagnoses the situation, and then there's a call for repentance. There's the use of a very interesting use of the hearing formula, let the one who has ears hear. And then each of the seven letters ends or contains within it a promise to the victor, to Ho-Nikon, the one who is victorious, to the one who conquers, I will give X. And in the different letters, it's something different. In the first one, the letter to Ephesus, I will give permission to eat of the fruit of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. And this is a wonderful promise. Obviously, you remember in Genesis that Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden specifically so that they would not eat of the tree of life. And here, Revelation starts early on by promising that people will be able to eat of the tree of life. The use of the tree of life image, I'll talk about at the end as we look at, you know, what do we do with this vision today. I think it's one of the most wonderful images in New Jerusalem, second only to the water of life, perhaps. But this is promised right at the beginning of the seven opening letters, and each of the other letters also promises something wonderful to those who conquer, to to those who are victorious, something that they can hold on to as a promise to get them through the whole rest of the book of Revelation. I mean, in a sense, these are the promises that we too need to cling to as we read through that scary middle section. The promises have already been glimpsed in the opening letters, and that's what then come to fulfillment in the New Jerusalem vision. For those who hang on through the tribulations, for those who come out of Rome, now it all unfolds in this portrait of the amazing city. And like I said, the actual structure of Revelation itself, where you make the breaks, is debated among scholars. But most scholars now follow this sort of concentric model of Revelation, where it's A, B, C, with a center section D. And they might break it up into more parts, but it's then concentrically where you've got C prime, B prime, A prime. And usually the C section has the seals and the trumpets in it, and the C prime section has the bowls in it, because those are definitely parallel to the trumpets, the bowls are. And then Schusser Fiorenza draws that parallel between the New Jerusalem vision and the promises. And then what you see also, I couldn't draw off the paper, but the framing effect of the letter structure, where the text opens and closes with this epistolary frame, or the letter frame, that sets it all in a context of letters to specific communities. Thirdly, then, Revelation's New Jerusalem vision is a fulfillment of Old Testament hopes and dreams. And I want to look at a few of those with you, simply because to see how he both uses the Old Testament scriptures and then also makes changes, I think can point out some of the wondrous aspects of this vision, where he makes great visions even better by transforming them into this wondrous city here. Specifically, I think the early part of the chapter, 21, 1 through 8, is modeled mostly on Isaiah, and we've heard about that text from Dr. Pannenberg, the new heavens and the new earth, making everything new. But with the tour of the new city that starts with the second descent, beginning in chapter 1, verse 9, it's funny that there are two descriptions of the descent of New Jerusalem, and scholars have long debated why that is. But anyway, beginning with verse 9, he's following as his model here primarily Ezekiel's vision of the new temple in chapters 40 to 48. And I just want to point out one section especially from Ezekiel 47. Does anybody have a Bible? Okay, if you have one, you might want to look at it, but you don't have to, because I'm happy to read to you. Ezekiel 47 here. This is, I actually don't even know if this is in the lectionary. If it is, I've managed to skip church every time this is read. But this is a wonderful text. At the end of the new temple vision, where all the gates and measurements and everything are described, then he describes the river of water that flows out from the temple, from the sanctuary. And that's this great vision of the water that gets deeper and deeper as it flows down to the Dead Sea, which is miraculous. I mean, for those of you who live in lands that have too much water, this isn't a hope-filled vision, but for people who live in a dry climate, the idea of the Dead Sea becoming fresh and this water that flows out from the sanctuary is really powerful. So an angel is showing him this river, and they're measuring it. It's first ankle deep, then knee deep, then thigh deep, then it's deep enough to swim. Then he led me along the bank of the river, verse 7 here, and as I went back, I saw upon the bank of the river very many trees on one side and on the other. And wherever the river goes, every living creature which swarms will live, and there will be very many fish. The sea will become fresh. Fishermen will stand beside the sea from Engedi to Engalam. It will be a place for the spreading of nets. Its fish will be of very many kinds. But its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They are to be left for salt. That's kind of a wonderful ecological insight. He knows that you need the marshlands. And on the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail. But they will bear fresh fruit every month, because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing. So compare that then to Revelation 22. I mean, this is great. This is an image of these wonderful trees whose leaves are for healing. Some of you might know Tom Christensen, who used to teach at LBI before it became Trinity College, and now he's back in Cameroon. But he has a wonderful book called The African Tree of Life about a specific tree in Cameroon called the Sore tree, beloved by the Baya people with whom Tom works. And the Sore tree leaves actually have some kind of medicinal power, so they are used as healing leaves. But also, the whole Sore tree has become a sort of gathering point for healing in communities, so that Tom talks about in this book, Jesus is imaged by Baya Christians now as our Sore cool thing, our Sore tree. And it's a wonderful sort of example of how the tree of life can be an incredibly kind of Christological and hope-filled image. With these healing leaves that Ezekiel first introduces, that John then picks up in chapter 22 and makes them even better. Because whereas Ezekiel's vision was for Israel, Ezekiel is a priest. His priestly vision is all about keeping foreigners out of the temple sanctuary. The first temple had been so polluted and defiled that God had to destroy it, he says, and I have some problems with that. But anyway, the image of a new temple, the gates are to keep people out so that this new temple will be kept holy and pure. And it's a vision for Israel. But what Revelation does is use that vision from Ezekiel, but expand it for the nations. And at several points in chapter 21, and then here in chapter 22, John opens up the vision to specifically add the nations in where Ezekiel didn't have them. So what you see with the tree of life in Revelation is this. Through the middle of the street of the city, on either side of the river, the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So he takes Ezekiel's idea of the tree with its healing leaves and then expands it even more wonderfully so that the nations are brought in here. He does that at other places as well. I mean, if you look at the vision of the city in chapter 21, the gates of the city are never shut. It's not a gated community. I don't know what this says to us, where one of the fastest growing models of neighborhoods in the United States now is gated communities. And here's this vision of a holy city. It has a wall, it has gates, but the gates are never shut because there's no night there. And into the city come the kings, the nations. They shall bring into it the glory and honor of the nations. The Ta Ethne, the nations, are invited into this vision at a lot of places where they weren't in Ezekiel's vision. And I think this can point to something important for us about the New Jerusalem vision. The biggest change John makes, however, is an interesting one. And that is that he says, I saw no temple in the city. So whereas Ezekiel's vision was all about a temple, what John does is make all of us priests and says, I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. Finally, I want to ask with you, what does this vision say for us today? And I want to especially focus on the tree of life and the water of life as images or metaphors that perhaps can enliven our ministry, especially in an ecological direction. And as I said, that's what I'm working on most of all. Perhaps the living waters of the book of Revelation, the waters that are given dorion without price, the waters that are a counterpart to the waters in the Babylon vision in chapter 16 that turned to blood, which were polluted and poisoned in the economy of Babylon. Perhaps these new cleansing, healing waters of God's New Jerusalem vision can inspire us also to offer a prophetic critique of some of the pollution of our rivers and waters and our ecosystems and watersheds, and then can be an invitation to people to find again the river of the water of life in our world. Same thing for the tree of life. This is an image that Larry Rasmussen works with, especially in his book, Earth Community, Earth Ethics. And if you haven't read that, I commend that to you. He has a whole chapter in there on the tree of life and how just stories about the tree of life. I can tell you some from up here at Holden this summer. Over in Narnia, each week there was a tree on the wall, and the kids in the Narnia program, the children's program, would write their names on a leaf and put them up on that tree of life. Larry Rasmussen tells about how at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro some years ago, the center image in the non-governmental forum where all the churches and other organizations were meeting was a tree of life that was a common symbol for all religions, yet so powerful for us as Christians as well. I mean, it's not in any way watering down the gospel. It's a beautiful image. And he talked about how children from all around the world had written their hopes and dreams on leaf-shaped pieces of paper that then were pasted onto this tree of life in the center of the NGO forum in Rio de Janeiro. Maybe we need to do more things like that, of bringing the tree of life into our lives and talking about this image. What does it say to the real trees of our world, to the deforestation that is taking place? In the Babylon vision, it's, I think, no coincidence that two of the cargo items on the merchant ships in Revelation 18, 12, and 13, that long list of cargo items, two of them are wood products, all articles of costly wood. We know that deforestation was a terrible crisis in the Roman Empire. You can see it clearly just by visiting any of the seven cities and seeing how Ephesus, for example, which used to be a port city, which used to be on the ocean, is now more than a mile inland because of the silting up of the rivers. This is, Greece used to be all forests, and even before the Roman Empire, Greece had largely been deforested. And this was a crisis then that I like to think at least John had some sense of in putting wood products on those cargo ships. We know from other ancient authors, a guy named Aelius Aristides, for example, how the ships that would come into Rome carried huge logs from trees chopped down in far, far away provinces. He says the hills in their countries are left naked, so that people must come here even to beg for their own produce, come to Rome. Perhaps Revelation's vision of a tree of life that is promised first in the letter to Ephesus and then comes to fulfillment in chapter 22. Maybe this can say something to us about how to deal with the crisis that our forests face in the world today, certainly out here in the Pacific Northwest as well as in the rainforests. The Philippines before World War II was, I think, 90% forested, and now much of that has been cut down. All around the world we're cutting down trees. Maybe God's New Jerusalem vision can offer an alternative and can give us a way out of this dilemma. I think, just to conclude here, because I want to have some time for discussion and hear what you're doing with these texts, it gets back to the magic eye idea and how we can help people see in the New Jerusalem a glimpse of a different alternative world, and then how we can invite people even now to live in terms of that. It's not a matter of building God's New Jerusalem. Certainly that has proved dangerous over the centuries when various utopian experimental communities have tried to build God's New Jerusalem here on earth. But I think it's a matter of glimpsing New Jerusalem. When I was doing my doctorate at Harvard, there was a bridge across the Charles River that had inscribed on one of the pillars this text from Revelation 22 about the river of life and the tree of life. And it was clear that what those, and it was on the Boston side, not the Cambridge side of the river, what those Bostonians were claiming was that the Charles River was somehow if not the water of life, related to the river of the water of life. And that Boston was somehow God's holy city. Now, there's a sense in which, of course, that is grandiose. But as you look out at your towns, wherever you serve, surely you've got a river that flows through there. Isn't there a way in which it's helpful to glimpse in whatever measly, puny little river that flows through your town, to glimpse somehow in that river, in that place, the home of God and the river of the water of life flowing through your town, just as it flows through New Jerusalem? And to glimpse in the little trees that are planted across your parking lot, however scrawny they may be, to glimpse as you look out your office window, to glimpse in that tree, God's tree of life, whose leaves are for the healing of the nations. And I think that's what we can be about. I mean, I'd love to hear your stories. You've heard about Narnia. I can tell you more stories where I've seen people actually using some of these images. But those are the questions. As we see dying communities, as we see dying hopes, how can this vision of God's new Jerusalem dawning even now in our midst? Okay. Well, now I want to hear from you. Where do you glimpse these visions coming to fruition in your lives, or how does it spin out in your communities?
Over the last year or two, I've been working with a lot of the material that Margaret Ward has been writing on the new vision, the Jesus seminar, that kind of thing. And he causes this idea of an alternative vision, a subversive ethic that was at the very heart of what Jesus had to say. And I'm just wondering, do you suppose that some of those ideas that are coming out now might have been in John's mind when he was working with the book of Revelation, going back into the Jesus tradition, looking at this subversive element, this subversive ethic, this alternative vision directed primarily to people at the low end of the economic scale, the tenant farmers have been forced off the field. We're now out there, hoping that some rich landowner would pay them a denarius so they could have a place to sleep and food to eat. It just seems to me that these two dovetail very nicely, but I'm not sure whether that's just, sort of life of Jesus or whether there's something here in the image of whether you try to go back.
Yes, there is. Sure, he knows the Jesus traditions. I mean, we don't know that he knew all the, synoptic gospel stories and stuff, but he's using the hearing formula that he uses, for example. Let the one who has ears hear. That's used also in the gospels. Jesus says that. And so certainly he knows the tradition of Jesus and is drawing on that. He's invoking that in a number of places. Yes, I think it's all the Christian community's vision. Uh-huh. I agree with you.
You asked for any short anecdotes. I asked the corroboration from Roy Jeremiah that the parish I serve is in a little town in Washington, the south loops and the north loops river meet, this narrow river valley. And the church in the past generation has needed some parking space, an old dilapidated house. Bought that property, put the house down. And as I heard from folks, there wasn't too much concern about that house going away anywhere, but there was a tree. Huh. There was a very tall fir tree, and there were a lot of folks who want to make sure, don't that tree. That's somehow a symbol for folks of continuity or what, I don't know. It's a lovely, lovely tree, tall.
Huh. There will
will surely be trees in heaven. We're in Chicago right now, we're having this Asian longhorn beetle crisis, and many hundreds of trees are having to be cut down, and people are weeping over their trees. Of course, we love our trees, and that's good. Thanks. Oh, many hands. Okay. You
go ahead. I started to get a feel for the culture of Oregon coming from Colorado. When I first came there, the street that my church is on has a little detour in the road, and the sign has a tree with the road going around it, and that gave me a little insight into Tualatin, Oregon. And because of that, they call it the City of Trees. I know there's many cities that take that same title, but we've adapted the life cycle of the tree to resemble the growth of the spiritual growth of an adult in the congregation. So that has been a neat connection to the community.
Thanks.
You asked for our stories this last Lent service.
Maybe we should have you stand up so everybody can hear.
This last Lenten service, Lenten season in Trinity Lutheran in Bonner's Ferry, and I can speak of this because the pastors who were there did it, not myself, had a marvelous series of Lenten services on the children's book, The Giving Tree, in which every week, starting with children, someone came and there was drama in which then they received from this tree. And it went on until finally an old man received from it. And the drama together with a Lenten homily were a beautiful example of how a tree could work into the Lenten theme.
Thanks.
Just leave it here.
You.
Yes.
What you said, our town, the only flowing water through our town is named Paradise Creek.
Huh.
And there are a lot of efforts to protect it. But one other thing that struck me in light of Dr. Peter's presentation and yours, it was only in the last 2 years that I realized that the scientific community, about six years ago, 93, 94, called on, among other people, the world religious leaders and all religious people to help. It was in their World Scientist Warning to Humanity. They said we need everybody's help. And I wondered how come I hadn't heard that from the church when it came out in 93, 94. It was signed by over 1,700 world scientists, many of them in the Nobel laureate. And since then, Union of Concerned Scientists and National Religious Partnership for the Environment have done a lot of work, including a beautiful video that we might use in our church.
Thanks. I just want to say that the Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter, if you want to see that, they have a webpage. It's like www.columbiariver.org or something, and that would be another example of that. I just thought of another story that I wanted to tell, if that's okay. Many of you know Pastor Bob Coelho, and because I don't think we have to only take these rivers in a theological direction. He's very sick again from cancer, but the first time when he went through cancer treatment, then he came up here to Holden and I taught on Revelation, and he said to me, Barbara, do you know what the river of the water of life was for me? It was the cards that people sent every day, a river of cards that came into my house and gave me hope. And I think the river of the water of life has many forms for many different people. Sometimes it's a river of cards like that, but it's the image of the river that he said was very strong for him. So I just wanted to give that as an example. Thank you for yours.
Thank you.
Yes.
At the north end of our church property, if you go to the house we own there, it shares a big maple tree with a business that was being remodeled. They had to expand the driveway. And here's this big maple tree, and we both own it. And I really had to do a lot of quick thinking to come up with, besides the fact that it's a beautiful tree that you don't want to cut down, well, why not? So we had an interesting conversation with a woman who's a veterinarian, literally asking her, why do you want to take away a bird habitat if you're a vet, And at the same time, what we ended up being able to do, we have an arborist in our congregation, this is helpful, and we could, the tree is so gracious that it can be wounded, actually, to make room for her driveway, but still exist.
Huh.
and be fine. And but at the same time, the arborist told us that in his experience, the biggest bone of contention between neighbors is trees.
Huh.
I mean, what to do with a shared tree?
Huh.
And here, and then Dr. Bonberg.
Oh, I have the fortune of serving at the east end of the Columbia River Gorge, which is an area that is the...
Can you talk a little louder?
Oh, I have the fortune of serving at the east end of the Columbia River Gorge, and where I served is near where the longest continuously inhabited place in North America is, at Celilo Village, and how that over the centuries, the 10,000 years that God through the Columbia River has sustained the native peoples, and even to this day our community is sustained by the power that comes from the dams and from the irrigation. And I'm just ordained a year ago, I'm going to be doing my first baptism of a fifth grade girl, and I'm going to, it's kind of, we don't do too many baptisms of that age, they're always older or younger, and so I'm trying to think of what to do for catechesis. And I'm going to take her down to the shores of the river and to see this wonderful, life-giving river coming across the desert, and to draw the water for the baptism right from the river directly, to have show that image of how God sustains us through the water and the river of life.
Thank you.
Dr. Pannenberg.
Don't you feel that you, in the last section of your talk, turned around the images of chapter 21 against the intention of the author of the Revelation?
No, but go ahead. I would just respond, it's certainly the case that the author of Revelation never collapses the future into the present. He holds out an eschatology that is decidedly not realized in the face of Roman imperial eschatology that says this is the golden age. John is definitely holding out the future as something very different. I would agree with you there. I think, though, that the way he ends on kind of a Eucharistic note, even, is an example, and how he starts the book by saying, blessed is the one who reads aloud, and I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. I think there's a sense in which in our worship as a Christian community, we already anticipate the future and experience it. The Spirit and the Bride say, come. Let the one who hears say, come. Let the one who is thirsty come. Let the one who desires take the water of life without price. It's an invitation to Holy Communion. And it's an invitation to experience and glimpse. And I use that word glimpse rather than see, I think, because it's true that it's a future vision. But to glimpse it even now at the Lord's table, in our baptisms, as you say, and then to carry that visions with us as we go out in the Monday through Saturday life of our world. I mean, I think that's always the task of is to both embody the already and yet the not yet, but to be bearers of the hope that God does give us for the future, and to help people glimpse the water of life already in their lives. So obviously it's a great tension, I agree with you, but I guess I would not say that it's a vision that doesn't have something to say to our present, especially as a critique of this world.
One more question or comment.
Seems that to disengage from Rome is a part of the concern, and to take it as we have been in the last few minutes, it seems like re-engaging somehow. Is it re-engaging with Rome, or is it re-engaging with the rest of creation?
Well, we always have to re-engage to live. That's the tension of our lives, is how to be out of Rome and yet part of the world. That's why we need community. I'm not sure I get your question. I mean, we have to be visions of an alternative community.
I wonder, too, if it was a primarily eschatological vision that gave us hope in the midst of living in an unjust society. Does that mean re-engaging with that unjust society to try to make it somehow
I'm not sure. What do you think? I know, of course we have to re-engage, but it's not in order to realize the eschatology. It's in order to point to the future and to the different world that God envisions. Well, it's a both and. I mean, we have to live. We have to pay our taxes. I don't know. I mean, it's a combination, I guess. What do you think?
Primarily as a philosopher and living with the injustice of Rome in the midst of that and not losing hope, I don't know how much effect it's going to have.
Well, there you are. Thank you.
Let me be